Welcome to What in God's Name? I'm Chris Owen. Shayna and Shayna's dog, Arlo, are away this week. We're doing current events and culture from a philosophical and theological point of view. We're grounded in Christianity, Shayna and I, and while being grounded in Christianity, we're reaching out in curiosity to all people of faith, to all people of no faith, as we seek conversations that begin in the recognition of our common humanity. There are two parts to today's show. Part one, we have a brief update from last week's show, and part two is the beginning of an interview I recorded recently. Let's start with part one. Last week, Shayna and I talked about masculinity and toxic masculinity. The context of our conversation was Gillette's marketing video on YouTube, and we used Albert Mohler's reflections on that YouTube video as a point of departure. Albert Mohler is president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and he hosts a popular podcast called The Briefing, which Shayna and I respond to from time to time. The update is this news that came out last Sunday. I'm reading from an Associated Press report. The San Antonio Express News and Houston Chronicle reported Sunday, so that was 3 days after our last show. These newspapers reported Sunday that their six-month investigation found about 380 Southern Baptist church leaders and workers who were accused of sexual misconduct since 1998. So that's the last 20 years, leaving more than 700 victims. The report goes on to say about 220 offenders, among them pastors, ministers, Sunday school teachers, deacons, and church volunteers, have been convicted or have taken plea deals. So that's the report from the Associated Press. My first reaction is one of sadness. As we use our moral imagination, we recognize that in these victims, innocence is destroyed, trust is broken, and these young people, mostly girls but some boys, have experienced a great trauma that will be with them for the rest of their lives. And so sadness is one response. The second thing I want to say about this, and this is an update then from our show, Albert Mohler, Shayna and I will take Albert Mohler to task at times on our show for sloppy reasoning or questionable theology. But I wanted to lift up and praise Albert Mohler for his response to this news of sexual abuse, his response on his podcast, The Briefing. His response was praiseworthy. He acknowledged the truth of the report, believing the victims, which is always so important. He condemns the victimizers, and he shows sympathy, compassion, solidarity with the victims. So while Shayna and I will challenge Albert Mohler's thinking and theology, credit where credit is due. Credible critics need to offer praise and support and affirmation when that is called for. So What in God's Name does a show on masculinity, and then 3 days later, this news comes out about sexual abuse in some Southern Baptist churches. It seems fair to say we will be revisiting this topic as time goes on. Part two of today's show is a conversation. Recently, I sat down with Dr. Gordon Graham. Gordon recently stepped away from his position at Princeton Theological Seminary, his position as professor of philosophy and the arts. Our conversation was about the prospects for public theology in the United States. In other words, what are the prospects for a show like What in God's Name? What do we have to offer to this culture? And what resistance might get in the way? Full disclosure, Gordon Graham was my advisor and teacher when I was enrolled in the Master of Philosophy and Philosophy of Religion program at St. Andrews University 30 years ago. And Gordon was the master, first-class intellect. And it was a little intimidating to go and have an interview with him 30 years later at Princeton. But it was great. It was wonderful to be in conversation with him. I hope you enjoy his thinking as much as I do. He's a brilliant intellect. My first question to Gordon was about, again, about this lack of theology in the public conversation. And from there, our conversation goes to our culture's deep commitment to equality, which is not always a good thing, according to Gordon. So let's take a listen to this conversation I had with Dr. Gordon Graham.
Part of what has propelled me to undertake this project, and I can tell you more about some of the other conversations I've had with different kinds of people, was an article that Craig Barnes wrote that appeared in the Christian Century. Yeah. He described his observation of how in the public conversation we hear from economists and politicians, military people, and we don't hear from theologians. And it was clear that he's observing this as a lament, that this is something our culture, our society is lacking, and it's not good that that's lacking. And so my first question is, do you agree with that?
Well, let me just say, one of the courses I offer here is called Political Philosophy and Public Theology. And this last semester had the largest enrollment ever, 52 students. And since we have small classes around here, that's quite a large number. And that's an indication, I think, of the interest that people within a divinity school, and of course they're not by any means all training clergy, people within a divinity school think that ought to have. The course, my course, is an attempt to get people whose primary interest is in what is called political or public theology, bring them up to speed a bit in political philosophy. I think that the problem is a twofold one. It's not simply that the world out there is not waiting for or does not think it needs a theological voice. The world out there also thinks, because we're in such a democratized culture, that over a wide range of issues, everybody's view is equally valuable, and there's a kind of hysterical anxiety about imposing views on people. So the resistance out there is not just we're not interested in religion or we're not interested in theology, but that there aren't experts or authorities in any of this in the way that there is in economics. Now, that's not a belief that you can actually sustain critically. You can see over the recession 2008-09 that economists couldn't predict this and had nothing to say about what to do about it. The same is true of political scientists. It's been said 1,000 times that the collapse of the Soviet Union wasn't predicted by any of them, despite years of Sovietology. So it's not true that these other social sciences produce real important punditry, but they are believed to. And it's the belief that there is no such space for ethics or theology that is part of the difficulty. But I think the other side of it is from the inside, and that is that within the academy, and that includes the Academy of Theology and Philosophy, there is powerful tendency to professionalization. And this is to do with accreditation. If you want to get your PhD, get your position, get your promotion, this requires academic publishing in the right places. That's the way it's gone. So the problem of speaking into the public space from either theology or ethics or philosophy is a double problem. The public doesn't think there is such a space, and the academy is highly reserved about the acceptability and the academic probity, you might say, of trying to fill that space.
Do you have any thoughts about how we've gotten to a place where, you gave two reasons, I'm going to focus on the one about how the public is not receptive. Do you have any ideas about how we got to that kind of a place? The story I tell myself is that at least part of the way that we've gotten here to where the public is not receptive to theological reflection is a byproduct of the Enlightenment, exaltation of reason and scientism.
I'm not sure that I think we have reason to trace it to the Enlightenment, because after all, the Victorian era, both in this country and in the United Kingdom, a bit less so in Europe, but that was an era of great religiosity. And if you think about in America, the Second Great Awakening, whose influence would be hard to underestimate, all post-dates the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. I think that the rise of scientific inquiry, not just Darwinian biology, but also historical criticism of the scriptures, that which rose in the 19th century, did generate a culture clash. It might be a little bit misleading to say it generated a culture clash. I think that it found a clash of cultures and then generated different allegiances. Great polarities came up. And the polarities, I think, found that the religious fundamentalism versus scientific enlightenment, that polarity sort of mapped on. I think cause and effect is rather tricky here. So I think that's a very important aspect of it in the United States. And of course, a famous book published some years ago called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, in which anti-intellectualism becomes a very important badge amongst some kinds of Protestant religion, but not just Protestant, I think. So the anti-intellectualism is a kind of anti-Northeast culture type. Anti-liberalism becomes anti-intellectualism. So I think there's a greater complexity here.
As you were speaking, I was thinking also of the liberal intellectual side of that coin. The high value it places on tolerance mm-hmm. tends to make it anti-religion because, in that mindset, religion is intolerant. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and of course, one of the greatest political philosophers of the 20th century, John Rawls, who might be thought to be the kind of supreme apologist for that kind of liberalism, was quite clear that a lot of it sprang from anxieties about the wars of religion and the death and destruction that flowed from them. Now, of course, my view, as we know from the 20th century, then to destroy other people and to do so with tremendous brutality is by no means the preserve of religions. So the most catastrophic calamitous destruction to fall upon human beings have all been secularized visions of new societies. The Stalin in Russia, Pol Pot in Cambodia, Mao Zedong in China, the Nazis. These are all avowedly secularized, non-religious visions of how humanity can itself make a new world and usher in salvation. And look, you couldn't begin to count the destructiveness of it.
I want to step in here, break the conversation for a moment to set up the rest of what you're going to hear today. Gordon and I are now, at this point in the conversation, going to turn toward a consideration of totalitarian forms of thinking and how true religion is anti-totalitarian. Especially interesting, I think, in what you are about to hear, are Gordon's reflections on the hubris, the pride,
of human political enterprises, human ideologies that say we can save ourselves. Humanity can remake the world. We can wipe the slate clean and start over. We can be the source of our own salvation. This is a great part of the conversation.
This goes afield of what I had prepared, but that makes me think of the totalitarian mindset, which, to my way of thinking, religion combats totalitarian thinking by, I don't know if preserving is the right word, but certainly the practice of religion holds a place of mystery that is impenetrable by totalitarian, so human totalitarian modes of thinking. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I suppose that might be true. I mean, true religion must, on all counts, invoke a certain kind of humility, yeah, and the humility in the face of mystery. And totalitarianism sometimes is indeed driven by a determination to master everything, the supreme mastery of things. That, though, that notion of the supreme mastery that's usually destructive is evident in the activities of colonial powers in times past that were not particularly secularized.
Right.
I would say that at the heart of the totalitarian enterprise and where the decline or absence of religion really kicks in a sort of Nietzschean vision. So Nietzsche famously says God is dead. But Nietzsche retains, curiously, a certain sort of religious sensibility, a sense of mystery. But what it drives on to then is the thought that humanity must be the means of its own salvation. There is nothing else. And the idea of being the means of our own salvation, rather than denying the mystery of things, that sense, I think, is what generates some of the more totalitarian efforts. So Pol Pot in Cambodia begins with year zero. We start over. And this, of course, has quite a long history. So the French revolutionaries, in the same spirit, wanted to reorder the world into a rational frame, hence the 10 days, 10 months, and so on and so forth. And I think it's that notion. And then allied to that is the idea that the salvation of humankind will be accomplished in large part thanks to the power of science and technology. So you get this hubris, what the ancient world would have called hubris, this pride that we can be the source of our own salvation, allied then to belief in science and technology. But this is not the preserve of secularized conceptions. If you consider the war on terror, which America under George Bush launched, and which has been one of the most, to date, by far, the most terrible thing to have happened in the 21st century, that really was the belief that with science and technology and military might and economy and a sense of right and wrong, then evil might be driven from the face of the earth. That is hubris.
Yeah, so that sense of that we can save ourselves is...
is, I think, the heart of the disaster.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think if a theological voice were to speak into the public culture, it would be at that kind of level that it would really, truly have something to say. That and also things to say about human relationships and social media, which is a huge thing now. I think that we're on the edge of people dealing with the problems that social media throws up, like they deal with problems of addiction, namely medicalizing them. Because that's the only place that the modern world has to turn. And similarly, I think, with the issues of consumerism and the drive into consumerism and the commercialization of life, it's very hard to see where there are resources in the ways that we think that could deal with that other than, for example, seeking greater equality. Let's not challenge consumption. Let's say, well, we don't want radically unequal patterns of consumption. And the war on poverty is another way. It sounds morally as though who could be against the war on poverty? But that is to say, let's all be consumers, shall we? So to address human pride and hubris, to understand the strength and limits of military might, to understand the place of politics. I mean, just take the present regime in America, the vision. Never mind, the slogan is an empty one, we know that. But make America great again. What is that? Cashed out, answer, jobs and prosperity. That's it. It's not let us have the finest colleges and universities, let us have the most spectacular national parks. Let's have it the case that the literary culture of this country is the envy of the world. No, it's jobs, jobs, jobs. It's the economy, stupid. You've heard it all. And that's the sole conception of greatness that we're left with.
Right, yeah.
And let's be fair, that's not simply a remark about the present regime. Nobody campaigning for president will say anything else. Can you imagine a presidential candidate or his advisors saying, you know, making tons of money and bringing ever higher levels of sales is not what we're about? Not going to say it.
And with this, we conclude part one of my interview with Gordon Graham. Shana and Arlo, our little Shih Tzu show dog, will be back next week for part two of this conversation. Speaking of conversations, we want to be in conversation with you. Send us an email through our website, whatingods.com. That's whatingods.com, or leave a comment on our Facebook page. We thank all our supporters. We thank you for listening. Share What in God's Name with your friends and family. And join us again next Thursday for part two of our conversation with Gordon Graham. Have a great day.